This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, Hilary Harper here with Life Matters. This January 26th, a special program on Radio National about the power of sport in our culture. Sport unites many Australians, regardless of background or upbringing. And today we'll hear two stories about how sport can promote real change in communities.
It's not just, you know, people of colour standing up for racism or for women to stand up for sexism. It's really, really powerful when you've got allies that can make a stand and be a voice for those that go unheard.
That's North Melbourne AFL club star Emma Carney. More from her later. But first, to cricket. We're in the midst of the Women's Ashes, the female edition of the long-running grudge match between Australia and England. And who better to talk about the evolution of women's cricket than someone who's represented Australia 251 times. Alex Blackwell is a former international cricketer who's played her share of Ashes tests, as well as T20 and One Day Internationals. In her new memoir, she chronicles the highs and lows of her career and some of the major changes to women's cricket that she's championed, as well as the challenges of being the first female international cricketer to come out as gay. The memoir is called Fair Game. Alex Blackwell, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you, Hilary. It's wonderful to be here.
Great to have you with us. Tell us first, what does it mean to you to play Ashes cricket? How big a deal was it?
Oh, look, it's the biggest deal. Kids in Australia grow up dreaming of putting that baggy green cap on. And as an Australian cricketer, you mentioned I played 251 games for Australia. Only 12 of those matches were tests where I got to wear that baggy green, that iconic image of Australian sport, that cap on top of your head. And it means so much to us, even though the tests are few and far between. There's a very rich history in the women's game of test cricket, dating back to 1934, when the first match was played between Australia and England for the women in Brisbane. So we treasure every opportunity to play test cricket.
I only just recently learnt that Peggy Antonio, who was 17 at the time, took 12 wickets during that test series. That's amazing.
Yeah, look, there's some wonderful stories from generations gone by that even I don't know well enough. And, you know, I guess when I sit down and think about, well, why have I written this book? Well, why not? There's so much rich sporting history in this country, and we should be telling the story of the women involved in our sporting history. And Peggy Antonio, absolutely, Betty Wilson, there are legends of the game that we really need to hear more about. So I'm hoping there'll be more books about women's cricket in the future.
Yes, and in the book, when you're writing about those really early days as a child with your twin sister Kate growing up playing cricket and not even realising that it was seen as a men's sport, you name drop all these amazing players that you were seeing on the TV and hearing about and were aware of. And I was thinking, I didn't have that. I grew up in the 70s and 80s and I had no idea there was a women's cricket team.
Yeah, look, even though I retired from cricket just a few years ago, I grew up without the notion of women playing on TV. And so you're right, my heroes were people like the Waugh brothers. Given that I'm a twin, of course I gravitated to watching the Waugh brothers. But isn't it wonderful now that young boys and girls can see women playing at the same time that they're seeing men playing? And there's really not a lot of difference. When you put the broadcast together in a high quality way, it's equally as entertaining to watch, and it's wonderful to see the investment now in the production side of things. But yeah, I didn't know women played until 1995, when our primary school girls team won the state knockout. It was the first time our school had put a girls team together, thanks to Mr. Cook. If it wasn't for him, Kate and I might not be playing cricket for a long career with the Australian team. But because of that primary school team, we won the tournament for the state knockout, and the captain of Australia, Belinda Clark, sent us all individually signed posters. And that was the first moment understood women played at a high level and there was a pathway to pursue if we wanted it.
Yes, because it started much earlier, didn't it, with a tree stump out on the farm and just trying to defend that.
That's right, yeah. I mean, I grew up one of four girls. My mum and dad weren't into cricket. They learnt to love it, maybe hate it too sometimes watching, because you have more bad days than good out there, and it's, I'm sure it's hard to watch your child come off disappointed. But, yeah, growing up in the country, especially with my twin sister, I always had a buddy to play sports with in the backyard. And, yeah, very vivid memories playing backyard cricket at my grandparents' farm. And yeah, it was lovely to reminisce about, you know, the magic of the game, getting into it as a kid and being able to document that in my book.
Yes, you talk about the magic of the equipment and, you know, yeah, looking through catalogues, we're going to get those pads, we're going to get that ball. And the day you went from shorts to culottes, why was that important?
Yeah, that's right. It's it was a step up going from playing cricket in little shorts as kids. Again, Kate and I would play against the boys in our local town, and there weren't any other girls playing at that time. But when we stepped up to play cricket in girls' teams, so the New South Wales under-17s rep team, we played in long socks and culottes, and that was the attire of the Australian women's team at the time. Terrible for sunburn. You get the terrible sock tan, especially behind your knees. And I mean, some people listening might not even know what culottes are. They're kind of these sort of flowy shorts that could be mistaken for a skirt, but terrible for sliding in you know, the rough outfield sometimes. You'd get grazes and sunburn. So, yeah, that is in the past now, but I wouldn't mind seeing a retro round in the WBBL perhaps, where we go back to wearing these fancy culottes and colourful attire and pay tribute to the generations gone by.
Well, and you talk about some of the allies that kind of stepped up and said, hey, you know, girls can play cricket too at various points along the way. And a difficult time for you and Kate when you were still quite young with sledging. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, as I said, Kate and I were the only kids, girls in town playing cricket with the boys, and the boys hadn't really sort of experienced that before. And I guess that it was sort of a natural thing at the time to sort of snicker a little bit because we were different. They hadn't seen this before. And, yeah, we did get a bit of a rough time. And in cricket, because it's somewhat of an individual sport within a team sport, you have a lot of focused attention on you, especially when you're batting. And so as little girls, we did get a lot of sledging, and we decided we didn't like it, and we actually quit cricket. Probably around aged 10, we quit and thought, no, we'll just continue playing soccer, because you don't get the same sort of attention, even though we were playing in mostly boys-only competitions. But, it did drive us away from the game, and unfortunately.
Well, and luckily you came back after a bit of a break.
Yeah, that's right. Fortunately, Mr. Cook from Griffith East Public School saw a bit of talent in the girls' cohort at the school in year six, and started the girls' cricket team for the first time. And once we joined back into that team, we realised we loved the game, and I didn't miss a season after that time until retirement. So thanks to Mr. Cook, because I think really that cricket is our true love, even though we played lots and lots of different sports.
Yeah, and you're right about having to sit down and seriously think one day, do I keep up with the javelin? Do I go for soccer, or do I look at all the skills involved in cricket and go for that? But it's interesting, isn't it? Because you can see how a lot of girls would go, well, I'm not going to stick with this game if I'm going to be discredited and sledged by parents and opposition as well. What are some of the remaining barriers, do you think, Alex Blackwell, to keeping girls interested, getting them interested in cricket and keeping them interested in cricket, that parents and clubs and teachers and the rest of us can help to break down still?
Well, it's wonderful now, Hillary, that the number one paid sport for women in terms of team sport is cricket. And I think that is a wonderful thing to aspire to be able to create a livelihood within the sport that you love, whether that be as an elite player, even if you're a domestic cricketer. Domestic cricket for women is now professional, but reaching the high echelons of the game playing for Australia, you'll be amongst the top paid female sports in this country for team sports. Look, I think it's no longer a shock to see young girls down at the nets with their dads or their mums, because it's become such a popular sport. Of every 10 new participants, 6 are in fact girls. So, in fact, we need to start thinking about how do we keep our young boys interested as well? I think the junior formats being shortened, sort of modified games, and making sure that the pitch length is the right length for the young children, because in the past we used to have kids playing on full-length pitches with full-size cricket balls, and, you know, it just doesn't work. It drives away kids because their enjoyment of the game isn't as high as it could be. So those modified formats, I think, have benefited boys and girls. And my hero, Belinda Clark, who captained Australia, a legend of our game, she actually was really instrumental in bringing the junior formats modifications in. It's been a huge success.
When we talked a bit before about your twin sister, Kate, and you write about how it was wonderful always having her there. You always had a playmate, you always had a cricket buddy, and the relationship, I understand, was fairly competitive. What's it been like for you having her there as part of your cricket journey and, I guess, going on to succeed in a way that she hasn't?
Yeah, well, I think that's one of the themes throughout the book, you know, being a female in a male-dominated sport, but also growing up to be the individual I am, and to do that alongside an identical twin sister. I think it's very, very special to be an identical twin. I don't know what it's like to not be an identical twin, but there have been challenges. Although we're the bestest friends and biggest supporters of each other, we did compete for similar roles within the New South Wales and the Australian women's cricket team. And so sometimes if it wasn't me playing, it was Kate taking that spot or vice versa. So it was challenging. I think ultimately we just wanted to be there together, and we did get that wonderful experience of playing cricket together in the Australian cricket team in 2004 in India. Taking the field in the green and gold together was an incredible moment, and it's a record that can never be taken away from us, because we became the first identical twins to play cricket for Australia at that time. And the War brothers, our heroes as kids, they were non-identical twins. So it was a really special moment. Perhaps having someone who was equally as competitive, it sort of drives you to be better. And it was great that we had each other to train with in our backyard. And Dad even put a cricket net up in the backyard, which was fantastic. And one day I was bowling to Kate and I broke her big toe with a really good Yorker, and unfortunately that meant that I got picked for the New South Wales team, and we were playing WA, and she unfortunately missed out due to injury. I swear it was not deliberate, but
I bet it still comes up at Christmas dinner. We're speaking with Alex Blackwell. She's a former international cricketer, played a lot of games, very highly regarded in the sport, and she's got a memoir out. It's called Fair Game, and it covers a lot of ground, literally and metaphorically, about her time in the game and some of the amazing experiences there as a female player, as a lesbian player, and some of the changes that have happened in the sport over that time. And Alex, really interesting to read recently that a lot of the research, when we talk about reasons why girls do or don't play particular sports, the research is saying that women and girls of various sexualities sometimes avoid sports because they don't want people to think that they're gay. Mm. What can be done about that?
Well, I think that is right. I think in the past, people have feared being labelled as gay, and that's due to growing up in a society that tells you in sort of subliminal ways, or, you know, subtle messages, that being gay is less than, and not worthy of celebration if you happen to be gay and in a cricket team. But I think that's definitely changed. I think nowadays young people see sexuality differently to the generations gone by, and there's a lot more fluidity in the way that people look at sexuality and experience it. So I think that's changed now. I think girls and boys pick the sports and the activities that they enjoy, and they're less pigeonholed in terms of gender roles and what's appropriate for males and females. I think also, you know, one thing I'm very proud of is ensuring that sport is open and available to diverse genders and sexualities. So not everyone is born strictly on the male or female end of the gender spectrum and biological sex. So I'm talking about intersex people. And in fact, in my other life as a genetic counsellor, that's one of my real areas of interest. It's a small number of people, 1 in 4,500 people have an intersex variation, but they exist. And I think we need to be ensuring that sport is open to all types of people, and even those who identify as non-binary or transgender. And I think that is one of our modern day challenges for sport, allowing access to our increasingly diverse younger population.
Yeah, and a younger population who don't seem to struggle as much as perhaps some of the older population do with that idea of nuance and diversity and shifting, changing gender identities. And, you know, obviously older populations are diverse too, and some people have no problems at all. But, Alex, that assumption that women's sport is largely the domain of lesbians has had some pretty awful effects for some players. How does that homophobia, or how has it manifested in women's cricket?
Yeah, so in the book I do describe what it was like for me growing up in a male-dominated and homophobic environment. We know that sport remains one of the pockets of our society, that there's a lot of work to be done to ensure homophobia is a thing of the past. We've done great things to move the conversation around racism. That's not completed yet, though, is it? We can still do more in that regard. But I think homophobia is still fairly common. When you look on the Out on the Field study that was done in 2014, over 6,000 participants from all around the world participated in a study, both gay and straight people involved in sport, and 80% have witnessed or experienced homophobia in sport, and that's simply not good enough. When we think about how positive sport is for our physical and mental health, it's a real target, I think, an opportunity for sports to ensure that we're not rejecting a large proportion of our population. So potentially 11% of Australians, but actually probably more than that. With emerging data suggesting that our younger people are increasingly identifying as non-heterosexual or not completely in that regard. So, yeah, it's a big opportunity for sports, and I do document what it was like to experience homophobia and to stand up to our leaders and administrators of cricket to say, well, look, this isn't good enough. I believe I'm worthy and equal as compared to anyone else. And being gay doesn't change any of that, in my opinion. And I think we need to do better at celebrating the people who have contributed to our sport. And yes, there have been a number of gay athletes in cricket. And sadly, I'm the first one to talk publicly about it. I think that's, you know, not something I set out to do, but I'm pleased to be representing people of the past who were not able to speak freely and enjoy the freedoms that we do today.
And there's been some pretty amazing moments chronicled in that journey. Alex Blackwell, people saying things like, we want to make women's cricket a place mothers would want to bring their daughters, with the implications that having too many lesbians around is bad for that. Bad luck if you're a lesbian mother. And one incredible moment when you were on the Cricket New South Wales board speaking with Eddie Maguire, and he claimed there was predatory behaviour among lesbian players. How did that moment strike you at the time?
It's a wonderful story in the book, and one of my favourite moments actually of my cricketing journey, because at that time when Eddie raised his point of view that predatory behaviour was something to address in AFLW, you know, I think I handled it in a mature way, because who am I to say that, you know, there aren't behavioural issues. I think we need to educate all people involved in sport about proper workplace behaviour. But I did feel like he unfairly targeted or profiled a type of person, you know, a group of people that I belong to. And I found it rather offensive, but being able to sit with him and explore what he, you know, what he really meant around that, and draw the conversation towards a more productive tone, which is about focusing on workplace behaviour for everybody. Certainly the AFL, the men's sport, has a lot of work to do as well. So, yeah, I thought it was not quite the right choice of language, and but respect to him, he stayed in the conversation, and we enjoyed a back and forth, which you would at the level of being a director in a sport. You need to be able to take on other people's opinions, and I feel like he did, and I certainly took on his view as well. But, yeah, I think we have to also look at the reality of what's happening within sports and not just what a perception might be. And I think, unfortunately, there's a perception when people look at the AFLW, because they're very physical women, strong, tattooed, short haircuts, that in some way signals what type of behaviour that person would display, whether that be in the locker room or off the field. And I think that's particularly unfair. You cannot judge someone by their looks, or by their sexuality. It's by their actions, and anyone can step out of line, and I don't think it's necessarily fair to target one type of person to start addressing workplace behaviour.
Well, and we've talked a lot, Alex Blackwell, about the attitudes that have been in and around women's cricket, and you write a lot about how they're changing, and you write with great excitement and enthusiasm about the opportunities, as you say, for moving forward and making change. Let's have a look, though, at the prospects for women players. You mentioned that women's cricket is relatively highly paid, but what about that issue where women sometimes have to work part-time while they're playing cricket and kind of shuffle their lives around that? I understand that you were studying medicine but had to change degrees in order to play for Australia. Do you wish there'd been a bit more support there and flexibility so that you could have perhaps done both?
I just feel I'm so privileged to have sort of lived both experiences. I bridged the amateur to professional eras, and there was such a charm in being an amateur athlete and travelling the world with your mates. Yes, you had to take time off work and you didn't get paid to do it, but you had another life. And I'm very privileged to have gone to university and gotten an education and gone into a career path that's very interesting for me, and that's in genetic counselling. So I do hope that our professional athletes these days continue, while they're paid a lot of money, continue to focus on how they're building themselves in a nicely rounded way that can give them confidence about when they exit the sport, because that's a really big issue these days, I think, athlete transition and how our elite athletes sort of emerge after they've had a wonderful career, whether that be long or short, to be able to then move on to the next steps. And it's very difficult at that time. I experienced that sort of shift in identity when you're no longer an Australian cricketer. Who are you? So I think it's really important that we continue to leave space for our elite athletes to be able to study. There's great options online now, and to support them in doing that. And in cricket, you can get your degree paid for now through the Australian Cricketers Association and their education grants. So there's really no excuse.
A pathway forward.
There's really great opportunities now.
When Alex Blackwell, you say, who are you now? Now that you're not a famous international cricketer, you're a genetic counsellor, you're an advocate, you're a commentator, and you're a writer. The memoir's called Fair Game. Alex, it's been lovely to chat to you today. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Hilary.
Alex Blackwell here on Life Matters Today on Radio National.
The bell has rung on the new year and 2022 is already changing our lives. Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis, and this week I'll be bringing you RN Breakfast with the news that changes your world, the people that change your mind, opening the door to new ideas. RN Breakfast, it's everything you need to start your day. Join me each weekday from 6 a.m. on ABC RN and the ABC Listen app. RN, think bigger.
It's almost a year since former Collingwood Football Club president Eddie Maguire resigned over racism and discrimination within the club. Here's a story we did at the time in response to that about how community sport can provide solutions that might filter up and affect real change at the elite level.
A kid came up to me from the opposing team and said that, of course, you would be one of the best basketball players here because you can shoot, steal and run, which was meant that I could shoot a gun, steal or rob people, and also run away from the cops.
If you see or experience racism on the field or the courts,
at school or at work,
or anywhere at all,
be brave.
Be brave.
Be brave.
Be brave. Speak up.
Hello, I'm Michael McKenzie. Welcome to Life Matters. That is an excerpt from a video that's already had 8 million views. The entire clip is played before the start of every game of the North Melbourne Football Club. We played it today to try and start a new, more hopeful discussion in the wake of that scathing report into the ongoing culture of racism at the Collingwood Football Club and the subsequent resignation of its longtime president. And we want to hear from you too. How does what happens in elite level sport trickle down into your community? And can building a more inclusive environment in community sport trickle back up to make changes in the professional game? If you have some examples of change, please get in touch. We'd like to hear those real life stories. With me are two players from the North Melbourne Football Club who have been embedded in just this kind of work. And the first of those is Emma Carney. Emma is a dual athlete. She's the AFLW captain of North Melbourne, but she's also a professional cricket player. In 2018, Emma won the AFLW Best and Fairest. She's also a teacher by profession and the head of education and careers for what's called the Huddle, which we'll talk about in a moment. But Emma, hello, welcome to Life Matters.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm really excited about this.
Emma, that video we just heard part of is called Be Brave, Speak Up, and you were actually asked to be part of it, weren't you?
Yeah, I was, and that was before I was sort of involved as a player at the footy club, but I was at the Melbourne Stars. I was a teacher at the local high school, so some of the students that were involved in that program I sort of knew as well. So to be asked to be a part of that was really special.
And as we've just heard, some of those really heart-rending comments direct to camera from boys who have often come from a diverse range of backgrounds, culturally and linguistically, talking really honestly about the kinds of discrimination they've experienced firsthand, whether it be on a playing field or in a classroom or just around the streets. I take it as a teacher, you would have heard those stories before you even came to the video.
Yeah, sadly I have. And I guess for me, I grew up in country Victoria where I was surrounded by people that were similar to me, and that was, you know, white Australians. And, you know, then to come to Melbourne and hear stories from people from culturally diverse backgrounds, and hear the discrimination they have, like little things like going into the supermarket and getting followed by security guards. That's something that, for me growing up, I've never had to think about, and never been discriminated against based on what I look like. So, yeah, it's pretty heart-wrenching, and it's really powerful, though, that we hear those young voices in that video.
Can I say too, though, Emma, you've experienced maybe a different form of discrimination simply because of your gender when you were trying to follow your deep passion of playing footy.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's exactly right. So I guess but for me, being a female athlete, it's had its challenges, and one in particular when I was a young girl, I could no longer play the game because I wasn't able to play with the boys, and that was when I was 12. So I hated AFL because I didn't have the same opportunities that my brothers had, and I had to stop playing. So I picked the game up again when I was 21. But, yeah, for me to be discriminated against because of my gender was really hard for me to take when I loved the game so much. But also with constantly receiving hate based on our gender, you know, people on social media saying that we shouldn't be playing the game because of, you know, we should be back in the kitchen. And it's like those sort of comments are really hurtful. And for people to be still in this day and age, still be using social media for that sort of hate speech, times have got to change. We've got to be better than that.
And, of course, that's one of the reasons why we're having this discussion today in light of the Collingwood report and, you know, some of the signs of hope that perhaps attitudes are changing and maybe we can look to local communities for that inspiration onto the elite playing field. Tell us about the huddle, because I know that's really part of the culture of North Melbourne.
Yeah, so the huddle's been around now for 10 years. So it's the community arm of the North Melbourne Football Club, and we leverage the power of sport to engage young people in the North Melbourne, Wyndham and Tasmanian communities. And we're really fortunate that in particular North Melbourne and the Wyndham areas are highly multicultural areas. So we work with a range of different cultures, I think. You know, we've engaged over 75,000 young people over 65 different cultures. So, you know, our programs aren't just related to sport. That's a big part of it. But we also offer educational support within schools. We do after-school tutoring programs. We've got women's-only sort of activities as well. So there's a whole range of different things that we try to engage young people in sport and you know, to create a socially cohesive environment is one of our main aims.
And if the huddle's been going for as long as 10 years, Emma, I know perhaps you haven't been involved necessarily from just the get-go, but are you sensing on the ground, either anecdotally or with evidence, that this kind of involvement of young people at that time of their lives is making a change in the way sport is being run and played in those areas?
Absolutely. It's having a huge impact. For a lot of these young people, we've helped them give them a greater sense of belonging. I think we all know that in Australia, sport is such a big part of our culture, and you know, sport can play a really powerful role in that it doesn't speak any languages. So we can just throw a ball out there and you can play a game of basketball, or you can play a game of soccer or football, whatever it is. So I think for us, you know, being able to engage these young people has given them a greater sense of belonging. Not just only in a sporting sense, but in a community sense too. So they're able to feel a lot more valued and feel that they, as I keep saying, is they feel like they can belong.
Emma, as someone who's worked at the highest levels of competitive sport in both football and cricket, we all know, as Australians, that no one minds a sledge or two when it comes to trying to psych out the other side. How do you prepare young people for that and saying this is where the line is, and if you cross that line, you may be being either homophobic or showing gender discrimination or being simply racist. How do you use language to show people where those boundaries are?
Yeah, I think it just comes down to that education piece. And, I mean, typically young people, I tend to not, you know, tell them about sledging and just let them play the game. But I guess it is natural for some people to be quite vocal on the field. You know, you can have a dig about their performance, but if it's about what they look like, what their, like their religion, their sexual orientation, gender, anything based on those types of things is just a no-go zone. And I think a lot of young people are starting to realise that. And I think a lot of young people are actually leading the way in terms of that sort of change in language that we use.
My first guest is Emma Carney, who is the AFLW captain for the North Melbourne Football Club. With me too is Ed Vickers. Ed's a former player for the North Melbourne Club as well. He's had to pull back a bit because of personal injury, but he has played top-level sport from a very young age. Ed has been a member of the Huddle Advisory Committee. He's worked on True North, which is a program we'll get into in a moment. He's also the winner of the Peter Scanlon Community Award twice. Ed, thanks for joining us.
Great to be on, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Ed, how did you get involved in the Huddle?
Well, as you mentioned, kind of 5-6 years ago, unfortunately got injured and had a bit more mental energy to spend, and had always heard about the Huddle in my first couple of years at North Melbourne Football Club, and was really interested into what they did and why they had such a great reputation in the community. And I entered the study support program. I was always into academics at school, and fantastic program where kids would come in 4 days a week after school with their homework. And that's how I got involved. I was a mathematics tutor for 3 or 4 years before I got involved in True North and ultimately the advisory board at the Huddle.
So you're the double whammy, aren't you? You're academically gifted, particularly at maths, so you can tutor the kids in that, which for many people, young people, would find an incredibly boring topic, but at the same time, you are a football hero. So you've got a passport to get inside their heads in a way perhaps other people don't.
Well, I think that's the idea behind a lot of the Huddle's programs now, is that we use our position as footballers to influence these kids in a way that we can share our experiences and resilience and leadership that we learn as footballers. And that's what people such as Emma have been so good at. They're able to relate to kids through sport and through football and share these experiences. And that's the True North program you mentioned earlier. That's exactly what it is. You get young kids in the community, and we're able to, through football and through sport, articulate to them how they can be more resilient as a student, as a friend, and also how to lead in the community and work on those personal leadership skills.
Well, some of the young women you worked with apparently were so enamoured with the way you approached this, Ed, you had a banner made. Is that right?
Yeah, I think in 2017 it was the first game back at Arden Street in, I don't know, 20, 30 years, and they had a big banner with my name. I think it was me kicking a goal, which was, I found it ironic because I've never actually kicked a goal in AFL footy. But they had a math equation with some hyperbolas on there. So, yeah, it was good to see that they saw the lighter side of maths. And I was able to make them enjoy maths, that they wanted to do that, which is the main thing.
And when you were playing through school and also at a professional level, and Emma, I'll ask you this as well, but at those levels, did you see examples from your teammates of racism, homophobia, sexism on the field? And if so, what did you do about it?
I think I'll go first. I think I was really lucky coming to North Melbourne. We had some great community leaders in Ben Brown and Jasper Pittard, and the amazing staff at the Huddle. I think that really permeated through the club's culture, that from the day I stepped in, I knew that behaviour from my side of things was never accepted. And it was always called up. And I think I mentioned Ben Brown, he was amazing at calling boys up whenever they said something or a little joke that was out of line. But so I was very fortunate in that sense. But I think Emma, you might have more to add.
Yeah, Emma, did you have this kind of situation you had to deal with both as a leader and as a player?
Yeah, I've never experienced anything on the field, and I've never heard any players, but like higher up on a higher level, so, you know, CEOs, when they use language such as man up or girly, which is still really common that people are still using, and it's that toxic masculinity is quite damaging. So I've actually pulled them up on it. And that's probably only in recent times that I've felt comfortable to do that.
Be brave. Speak out. You did it.
Well, yeah, exactly. But if I was to take myself back to, you know, my early 20s or my teenage years, I probably wouldn't have the confidence to stand up. So, you know, I think it's super powerful when you've got allies, and it's not just, you know, people of colour standing up for racism or for women stand up for sexism. It's really, really powerful when you've got allies that can make a stand and be a voice for those that go unheard.
Early on, in the first few years, Michael, of my career, I think I probably fit into just the kind of group mentality of the hyper-masculine football environment. And it wasn't, there weren't those role models. But as I mentioned, say, Ben Brown, and you slowly get in that male environment more and more people who frequently speak up, that it becomes the norm to speak up rather than the exception to the rule. And I think that's the thing, that over time we hope we get more and more of these people, as Emma mentioned, these allies. But in time, it definitely becomes the norm to speak up, not you're a bit blown away when someone pulls someone up for saying something that's out of line. And at the Huddle, we can see the how much that unites people from multicultural backgrounds. And I think that's the thing, we need to set the standard. And my experience at the Huddle showed me that we could bring other sports involved. And I think the AFL can learn from that. And it's great progress, but there's a long way to go.
Well, both of you are educators, and I think in this discussion what's really come to the fore is that education is the key. And Emma, just to finish with you, as a teacher as well as an educator within the football itself, are you sensing that the kind of resilience you're hoping to build amongst the next generation of young men and women, so many of them coming from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds, that there is a desire to enter sport and they feel confident that they can and hold their place?
Yeah, I think building resilience in young people is probably the number one thing that I try to do as an educator. It's so complex being a teenager, as we've all experienced. It's even more complex when you've got parents at home that have limited English skills. Your skin colour may be quite different from others that you're in the classroom with. You know, even things like you're getting discriminated outside of school based on what your name is or what you're looking like and things like that. So for me, it's about celebrating differences. We don't want to have everyone that's like me and Ed. It's so important to hear from different voices, diverse voices, you know, whether it's men or women or people of colour, Aboriginal people. Like, it's so important, and hopefully we can hear, particularly from an AFL point of view, we can see more people from culturally diverse backgrounds in leadership positions, because that's definitely something that's lacking at the moment.
Well, I wish you all the best in your ongoing work in this area to both of you. Ed, Emma, thanks so much for taking the time.
No problems. Thanks very much.
As well. Thanks, Michael.
And we're asking you today, how does what happens in elite-level sport trickle down into your community? And can building a more inclusive environment in community sport then trickle back up to make changes in the professional game? You might have some examples of positive change. And if so, please get in touch. We'd love to hear these stories. There's a post on the RN Life Matters Facebook page where you can leave your comments. Now, listening into that previous conversation is my next guest, Dr. Haas Dalal AO. Dr. Dalal is the Executive Director of the Australian Multicultural Foundation. He's worked for 30 years with professional, community and children's sports clubs across a range of codes to help them make a more inclusive gesture, to actually do something positive. And Haas said he's seen the power of sport to change culture from both the ground up and from the top down. If everyone, and this is the big thing, if everyone involved in those sports is doing their bit. And Haas, welcome to Life Matters.
Good morning, Andrew. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. We've all seen the impact of the Collingwood report, Dr. Dalal, on the clubs. But as someone who's worked so closely with kids and families on the sporting field, do you believe the behaviour of players and clubs at an elite level does have an effect on kids and families at the community level? Do those attitudes trickle down?
Look, definitely. I mean, whilst acknowledging that we still have a lot of work to do and that institutional and structural racism still exists across the different codes and the elite at the elite level, there's also been some great development. And I think, you know, what we need to understand, as you say, that, you know, sports at the elite level have a real long arm and or tentacles into the community. And if the culture is not right, then, you know, I think there's a long-term effect for the club or the sport code itself and the community that it works with. So their influence is significant in changing and shaping attitudes and particularly behaviour. And it was just so great to hear Emma and Ed talk about their experience at the huddle. I mean, I've had a working history with the huddle, and I think a demonstration of that, so I can go back 10 years when it was established, and at the time where the CEO of North Melbourne Football Club of that time, Eugenia Rocker, and was really a driving force who saw the incredible cultural benefits of getting to know its community that it was actually located in. So the work started really at that grassroots level. But I think what's really significant here that and the benefits of this is that it was in twofold. That first, it set a benchmark and a model at the top, at the leadership level, and which then helped to create a better understanding of the culture of that club with its management, its players and its members alike. So I think, you know, leadership from the top, it becomes really imperative to set that sort of benchmark where organisations, you know, need to be a lot more mindful and not, you know, not to be tokenistic and to be vigilant and protect the values the club should promote and develop those leadership positions that truly reflect the diversity of the community that they represent and that they are working in. And it really comes from the leadership. And so so it's very important that they provide a safe process to, you know, in order to make complaints and to be dealt with in an open and transparent way whilst protecting the individuals making that complaint. So I think it becomes really important to ensure that your code of conduct and your governance structures need to be accountable, practical and responsive.
Well, Hase, you've mentioned a number of times the responsibility of the leadership within certain sporting codes and clubs to really set the example, set the culture for all those below. And I'm just wondering, as someone who's worked within the huddle itself and worked, you know, with some of the people who are doing that kind of outreach, is that kind of program sadly still the exception rather than the rule?
No, look, I think, as I said, there's a lot of progress that is happening within the sporting codes in terms of good progress and you know, with a lot more awareness programs on diversity and gender with many of the codes. And that's why while we're seeing a great increase also of levels of participation at the local sporting organisations where there's a, you know, feel they're more accessible, they become a safe place for free from discrimination for young people to be involved. And I think the elite sports people are getting more and more involved at that community level. So what they're seeing is a greater reflection of what society is today in terms of all forms of its diversity. We see a great community-based programs with professional sports people and community members. I mean, for example, the campaign that you've just heard with the huddle, there are lots of sporting codes now working with their communities to develop those anti-racism or anti-social behavioural type campaigns, because I think what's really important for sporting codes at the elite and community level that can help communities grow together, break down those stereotypes and whether it's conscious or unconscious biases, I think what they are doing is they're really interacting with young individuals or people who really understand the day-to-day feelings of people who live with discrimination because of either race, colour, ethnicity, gender or religion. And ultimately that makes a change because the sport's about bringing people together. And that does influence the elite sport clubs, the players themselves, and develops a meaningful partnership, and the messages become real. And I think there's sincerity in those messages. And I think elite sports clubs are getting better and better because they can see the negative effects of discrimination, of racism, or for people not being part of a community or not having that sense of belonging. And I think it's really important that, you know, one of the greatest barriers to participation is the fear of the unknown and unknown. And sporting codes and clubs are the perfect environment to break down these fears. You know, programs that connect the sporting elite and its management to the community at the grassroots level will ultimately reflect the diversity of that community to the code and at the elite level.
And I would have thought too, Dr. Dalal, that in purely pragmatic terms, you want the best talent in your region to feel like they're included and that they belong to a potential sporting culture, because that's how you find those amazing players in whatever code you're in, coming forward and going, I feel comfortable being here on this playing field with this bunch of people, and therefore the clubs and the codes all benefit.
Exactly right. Look, today, young people and diversity are the cornerstone of Australia's success, and that respect of the human rights of each individual is essential for a fair and equal society. It's, you know, our fair go. That's what we talk about. And therefore, we've got to ensure that young people from all backgrounds, migrant, refugee, Indigenous, have every opportunity to succeed in Australia and to achieve their aspiration in life by generating genuine opportunities for individuals in our community. And sporting clubs must continue to work to ensure that they all feel that all people belong and can participate fully in Australian society, in order to recognise not only just the talent, but just the level of participation. I mean, sports has an incredible impact on one's attitude for the future, in terms of their positive attitude to life and people. And I think because it is a neutral ground, sports have the opportunity to actually normalise diversity in all its forms, because it is neutral.
Do you sense, Huss, that the kind of exposure given to the Collingwood report into its cultural racism and the subsequent stepping down of its president has made other sporting clubs and clubs reflect strongly and seriously about how they can address what may be gaps in their own attitudes?
Look, I think this work has been going on for a long time, simply because I think, you know, we in Australia, being a country that with rich in diversity, really it's important to ensure that there's greater acceptance and appreciation of that diversity. And any process that promotes that sense of belonging, where individuals and communities are actively investing in society, then it becomes a very positive way to promote cohesive and productive society, and a productive society. And I think the sporting clubs are realising that, particularly with their connections at the local level. I mean, they live and breathe that diversity. That's their future, you know, membership, their future players. That they are more and more engaged. And we see that through examples like the Huddle, through Footscray. You know, there's a whole range of clubs that work hard in this area. But I think the thing is that, you know, when there is an issue, you need to confront that issue head on, and ensure that that what you do is, as I said earlier, is to be more vigilant and protect your values. Because I think at the end of the day, if ultimately you want to make change, because sports are about bringing people together, and if you don't, then you're actually contradicting one of the more important values and functions you have as a sporting club. Mm-hmm. You've got to have your code of conduct and governance structures need to be accountable, practical and responsive, just not just on paper. And if you as a club promote, you know, if you're continually promoting the values of mental and physical well-being, so therefore, if you don't deliver that, don't remove those barriers that are impediments, then you're actually contradicting those very strong values that you're actually continually promoting. So I think clubs are starting to realise the importance of this, and more than just the spirit of competition, it's about bringing people together, because they have such an important function in promoting social cohesion.
It's been great to have your insights. Thank you so much for joining us here on Life Matters.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Dr. Huss Dalal, AO, Executive Director of the Australian Multicultural Foundation. We're talking here about the impact of sport as role models from the elite level trickling down into the community and then reversing that movement and the trickle-up effect.
That's it for us today. But next time, a look at the history of exercise. It goes back far longer than you might think. Sure, Jane Fonda rode the wave of the 1980s fitness boom, but long before exercise videos were a thing, Hippocrates and Plato were influencing the idea of exercise as a form of physical activity. That fascinating discussion on Life Matters next time. I'm Hilary Harper. I look forward to having your company then. And step 2, 3, 4. Hop, 2, 3, 4.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.